How do you feel about New Zealand First post-election holding the balance of power?
Well, it's a bit of a nutty system that results in these kinds of coalition negotiations after the fact, and only one that's really willing to negotiate with both sides on it.
Is that nutty?
Well, you could do a little better.
It's just
on
it. I mean, the Germans are going through the same sort of thing, aren't they? Well, took them a while to sort out for the CSU just to get a CSU just one form of Christian Democrats to make a deal with the Christian Democrats in Bavaria, and now they can talk to the other parties.
Yeah, can take a while to form the coalitions there. It was looking like you might get something in New Zealand terms that would be National ACT and the Greens in German terms. So that seems to be off the table here, which is a bit disappointing if you want free market approaches to environmental protection. You can imagine some pretty good outcomes around water management that might come out of a national green discussion. They've not really been going there yet, though.
Maybe that's because in New Zealand, you could argue the CSU's parties, the Christian Democrats, in terms of economic policy, might be slightly to the left of the Labour Party here.
I'm not an expert on German politics.
Yeah. Nor am I, but I do wonder whether maybe that's one of the reasons that the Greens find it easier to do a deal there than they would here.
Well, Germany only very recently put in a minimum wage. They didn't even have one prior to a couple of years ago. They have reasonably liberal rules in a few areas, but New Zealand does do better in the economic freedom rankings.
Now, you're running a series on the website, The Spinoff, at the moment, which I think the title is Outside of the Asylum, or The Outside of the Asylum. Got to put the definite article in there. A New Zealander's Guide to the World Out There, which appears to have an underlying message, maybe more than underlying, that we're much better off here.
Well, all of the debate around immigration over the last couple of years is making me reflect on how lucky I was to be able to get in while people were still allowed to. I moved here in 2003 after getting a very nice job offer at the University of Canterbury. And when I stepped out of the plane and got to know the place, it felt like I had moved to Douglas Adams's Outside of the Asylum. So if you remember in The Hitchhiker's Guide, there was a guy named Wonko the Saint, John Watson. He read the instructions on the outside of a packet of toothpicks, which said, take the stick, insert between teeth, wiggle gently. And he decided that a world that needed instructions on a packet of toothpicks must be mad. So he built a wall around his beachfront property, decorated the outside of the wall for the inmates, and put a nice sign over the door saying, welcome to the outside of the asylum. We should have those signs up at customs here. So welcome to New Zealand, the outside of the asylum. Because it is 2002, 2003, I was on the economic job market. 9/11 had just happened in the U.S. The airports were armed camps. Going to the airport, you're going past a guy who's standing with a machine gun on top of the Humvee, the big 50 caliber one, or well, I'm assuming it's 50 caliber. I don't really know. Standing there with the machine guns, and then plenty more machine gun officers in the airports. You have to take off your shoes because some guy tried to blow up an airplane once with his shoes. New Zealand, a few years later, an attempted airplane hijacking. Reinforce the cockpit doors, make sure she gets some mental health treatment after prison, and trespass her from the airports to make sure it doesn't happen again. It's a far more sensible, scaled response. So,
Don't think that's just because we're a smaller country?
Well, we're a more sensible country. Small places can do crazy things too, right?
Mm.
But here, we recognize that going overboard on some regulatory measures, we just can't afford it, so they're off the table already. And it's just a more sensible approach. So I got here.
You're from Canada, right?
I'm originally from Canada,
it's a Canadian accent.
Yep.
But most New Zealanders would regard Canada as a pretty sane country, Eric.
It's among the world's saner countries, but it's not sane.
Why did you leave?
I left Canada to go to grad school in the United States at George Mason, and I left North America for New Zealand because I was very lucky to have the chance to come here instead of staying there. So if we think about the madness in the U.S., I talked about a little bit of that and can go through more of it after. Canada has a different kind of madness. I grew up on a farm there, farming in Canada.
What sort of a farm, Eric?
It was mixed horticulture, a bit of strawberries, raspberries, mostly cattle and grain, but there are lots of things you just couldn't do unless you bought quota. So if you think back to the old regime here prior to 84, in agriculture with quotas and subsidies and just crazy bureaucracy. Most of Canadian agriculture is still like that. So if you wanted to do eggs, then there's poultry and egg supply management board. If you wanted to do dairy, there's the dairy quota management system where it costs about $50,000 to buy the right to milk a cow. And if you want another cow, then you have to buy another license for another cow. The price varies province to province, but it's not cheap. And they get handed down from father to son. And classmates
that
of mine...
That could have been yours, Eric.
Oh, well, no, we didn't. We avoided being involved in those kinds of
Did your parents
areas.
Say, get away, don't become farmers?
They
Do you have any desire? Or did they have any desire for you to take over the farm?
I think my grandfather sure did, but my parents... saw that I wasn't really going that way. They didn't really have to tell me. Standing outside at minus 40 helping to birth a calf in February in Canada is advertisement enough against doing that.
But it's more than that for you. I mean, I would have imagined that if you didn't have to buy quota to milk cows, you might be more conducive to staying in Canada. That's the crazy stuff, right?
All of that stuff just pervades through the system then, right? So... Baby formula is too expensive. Cheese has 300% tariffs at the border, despite Canada somehow getting into the TPP arrangement. You ended up having cheese smuggling into Canada because of the 300% tariffs. You can almost imagine heroic mice going to smuggle cheese in for mouselings in some Pixar movie. But that's basically Canada, and there's real stories about... And there are even police that were involved in some of these smuggling operations.
Well, I'd be tempted to smuggle cheese into Canada. It might pay for my trip.
Well, at a 300% rate, just don't get caught.
Yes.
You'd also have other nuttiness where, like for fishing in... Like Manitoba, like Winnipeg, the Freshwater Fish Marketing Corporation controlled all of that, which is a government supply board. So any fishermen had to sell their fish to dock at Selkirk, which was great for the fishermen near Selkirk, but terrible for the Aboriginal fishers at the north end of the lake, whose product was mostly spoiled by the time they get down there. It was not set up rationally.
We've talked about Canada. You've obviously got first-hand experience there. And you're telling me that it's not as sane as it appears to be from the distance of the other side of the Pacific Ocean. What about the rest of the world, Eric?
America is pretty nutty. We've gone through some of that around the airports. Just think about policing. We don't know how lucky we are that we've got one of the few unarmed constabularies out there, right? So regularly, the police aren't carrying sidearms, and it's basically safe for them. The police union will occasionally say otherwise, but there was a 2015 study showing that over 123 years, 29 officers were killed in the line of duty, so it's far safer than farming, when plenty more farmers are going to be killed in on-the-job accidents. In the U.S., by contrast, Army surplus equipment was going to the police, so armored personnel carriers and all the like, and at the same time, the incentives set up for the police were just absolutely abhorrent. So they have a system there where they wanted to try and fund policing operations through the proceeds of crime. So under civil asset forfeiture rules, and crazily enough, go back to old Admiralty law about piracy. So back in the 1700s, it was pretty difficult to stop pirates. If you had their ship at port, they made the rules that you could arrest the ship rather than the pirates, because if the captain got away, he could just recrew it with new staff, right? So they declared that the ship was guilty. That's basically the approach that they've taken to deeming property to be guilty in the U.S., and then you have to prove that your property is innocent to get it back. So that's turned into too many places into road stop checks to basically steal cash from people, and especially people coming in from out of state who would have time and effort costs in trying to recover their property. Worse, just down the road from where I went to grad school, after I had moved to New Zealand, a guy named Sal Colosi got killed at his front door by a SWAT team. He was an optometrist, and an undercover agent had convinced him to do some sports betting, because gambling's illegal there. Can't go to the TAB. Depends on the state. They convinced him to gamble enough that they'd be able to seize assets from him. They went with a SWAT team to enforce it, and somebody with an itchy trigger finger shot him and killed him. Just an optometrist who liked gambling too much at the pub. We're very lucky not to have that kind of setup here.
The United States at the moment probably does have the reputation, the image outside image of being a little bit nutty because of its president, rightly or wrongly. We think it's maybe has lost the plot a bit. What about Europe?
Oh, sure.
I mean, the Germans, I mean, we think about what Germany's managed to do, unify East and West, former Soviet bloc with the West. And it's done it in a reasonably coherent, socially cohesive manner. Isn't that an extraordinary achievement?
Well, that is fantastic.
Those Scandinavians and even the Dutch, they don't seem too crazy. I talked to a Latvian, no, Estonian. Got to get that right. Baltic states, they sound pretty smart, those Baltic states.
The Baltic states are doing some pretty remarkable things. Digital governance in Estonia is very, very good. They're an example we could look at. If we look to tax systems, though, New Zealand does very well comparatively. So you hear all kinds of calls for exempting things from GST. You can look at some of the VAT systems in Europe and see where you go that when you follow that route, or across Australia or the UK. So in the UK, they decided that basic foods would be tax exempt, restaurant foods would not be tax exempt. So then you had lawsuits about whether a Cornish pasty were taxable or not, depending on whether it were heated or not. And you ended up with a 13-year lawsuit over a Marks and Spencer tea cake and whether that counted as a basic food or not for tax purposes. New Zealand's system is clean and comprehensive. We don't have to have tea cake deciders. In Australia, they had to have an Italian expert in to decide whether... They flew this guy in from Italy. So in Australia's broken GST, basic food items are exempt from GST and luxuries aren't. So bread is exempt, crackers weren't. So you'll always get edge cases, right? So people will pretend that this is all easy. You could just ask your grandma what she would recognize as basic food. There's always going to be edge cases. And these kinds of edge cases are ones where you don't know which side of the line it's going to fall, and the lawyers on either side will try and argue it. So they had to fly in an Italian bread decider to decide whether this mini ciabatta should be counted as a cracker or a bread. And even worse, this guy was certified by the Europeans as being an expert in bread deciding for tax purposes. Like, how crazy does your tax system have to be to wind up certifying experts in this?
Pete has sent through a text. He's arguing there's some insanity in this country.
Oh, sure.
In reference to your discussion with tonight's pundit, he's Eric, by the way, Pete, his assertion of the insanity of people smuggling cheese into Canada, right here in God's own, Mr. Key makes $5 million of capital gain on his house, doesn't pay a cent of tax on it, while in the same city, people were sleeping in cars. Now, that's insane, writes Pete from Auckland.
Now, people can argue and toss about capital gains taxes. At least the tax system on income is pretty fair. The GST system is very efficient. It's one of the lower ones when you look across the value-added taxes, but it's very efficient in collecting tax. Whether you want to have a capital gains tax or not, tax experts do argue the toss over this one. I'm not sure that you want to rule a country crazy or not crazy for not having one, because there are pretty good arguments on either side of it.
Perhaps there's a bigger question that Pete's hinting at there, and that is, if we're really that sane, how is a country with such a low population density manage to have such a shortage of housing?
That's one of the parts of the asylum that's crept in. So New Zealand's urban planning legislation, totally crazy. Auckland has gotten a lot better with the unitary plan, but we have set up an incentive structure for local government that they don't want to allow more growth because they bear a lot of the costs of it. The benefits of more growth go to central government. Infrastructure is expensive. So they delay putting out new water lines or new trunk infrastructure that would allow new development, or upgrading trunk infrastructure in town to allow more densification. Yeah, New Zealand is totally insane on that particular feature. And it underlies a lot of the other things that people would see as crazy, and like homelessness outcomes that you'll get, hardship that you'll get because of crazy housing costs. Those are real. Those need to be fixed. They threaten our outside of the asylum status.
One thing that interested me the other day, I think we had some productivity data come out, and New Zealand productivity appears to be flatlining at best. And I actually had Brian Easton sitting in that very seat that you're in now, and I talked with him about that, and he talked about New Zealand being, well, I said, have we become a low-wage economy? He said, no, we're a low-skilled economy. Would you agree, Eric? And isn't that a bit crazy?
Well, we've had a little
given our history of education and I guess the standard of living in this country, how have we managed to become a low-skilled country?
We've exported some people who are very high-skilled kids. New Zealand is small and distant, and the most skilled people can do far better in much bigger places, and there is nothing that policy can do about that. It can't, unless you want to make Auckland big enough to be able to compete with Sydney or London, which is never going to happen, that part's unavoidable. We have self-inflicted rules, productivity losses that are caused by the urban planning regs around housing, making land too expensive, making it too difficult to engage in business in our most productive places. We have some problems in education policy. On the whole, it stacks up reasonably internationally, but there's a lot of things we could do better.
Looking at the world map, I was just wondering whether the craziest bits at the moment are English speaking, whether maybe we should be learning another language.
Okay.
Maybe that's just because we tend to get more news from English-speaking countries, and because we journalists focus on bad news, then we get the bad news from a la Julian Assange or a la Brexit or a la Mr. Trump.
I guess it depends what you count as English-speaking. English is spoken through English is spoken through much of Europe, right? Even if it's not the primary language. You're right that America has gone nuttier. The UK is one of the, it's been disappointing. New Zealand's a nice little island.
Getting back to New Zealand, well, that's the thing, though. New Zealand's a nice little island. And see, that rings true with people. And then they say, well, yes, and let's keep them out. Because if we have too many, then we'll lose it. Obviously, you have a vested interest in maybe arguing that.
Well,
go ahead and argue.
No, people come here because they love what New Zealand has to offer. And I don't know why somebody would come here in order to break that, to vote for the kinds of policy insanities that they had back home that they were trying to escape. I'd slip my wrist before I'd try and put supply management on New Zealand dairy and bring back here the craziness that we had there. You don't go to a place in order to make it look like the place that you just fled.
I forgot to mention Asia. Okay, that's a rather general geographical area.
Just
which accounts for about well over half the world's population. But I was Asia's busy developing. Large chunks of Asia have been growing and developing and getting rid of some of the extremes and poverty.
Yep. I'm not saying that there are other parts of the world that aren't good. I'm saying that New Zealand is, comparably speaking, the outside of the asylum. That it's fantastic that China has mostly come around. There's still all kinds of crazy and horrible things there in policy.
Totalitarianism, yeah.
Totalitarianism, things they do to prisoners, all of the Falun Gong problems, stories about forced organ harvesting that you get confirmed out of some Canadian legislators that went over there. On the whole, fantastically better than it was 40 years ago. New Zealand still looks very good by comparison to any of them, though.
Well, then getting back to New Zealand, and as you said, nobody who's come from that craziness would want to vote that sort of stuff into this country. Well, what do you hope to see out of the coalition agreement, assuming we have a coalition agreement by the end of the week?
I'd really hope that we start addressing housing first. Both National and Labour have different plans, but they would both basically work towards fixing the problem. They're both addressing supply constraints. They're both looking at better ways of infrastructure funding. They're different ways, but they both work. Labor layers onto that a big Kiwi Build program that's probably unnecessary if you get zoning right, but at the scale of the lack of housing that we've got now, it's not going to be that bad. And there's been less attention on demand-side measures, so it's unfortunate that the last budget has increases in the accommodation supplement in it. Those will tend to just push up rents, but there's a reasonable focus on housing supply. I'd hope that we can make sure that other parts of the asylum don't creep in. So bits of the kinds of civil asset forfeiture legislation that I was talking about in the States have come in here, and the police are seizing assets. Yeah. Those are going into a fund that can be directed.
A whole gang kind of thing, bandwagon. Yeah. Which has been going on for years, but every now and then it gets another little kick from politicians.
There's a 2009 legislation that changed the rules so you can have civil asset forfeiture here without conviction, the same kind of regime that they have in the States. At least here, though, the money doesn't go straight to the police department. It goes into a fund, and various departments can apply to that fund. But it's a crack in the asylum wall.
Yeah, well, asylum, that's reminded me of another thing. You talked about more resources being put into the housing market and changes in the law to allow the private sector also to produce more houses. Mm-hmm. What about some investment in our mental health system? There are a whole bunch of people at Parliament today saying, and I hear anecdotally a lot of really sad stories about people who are falling through the cracks. That's one area we could do better in, asylum-wise, isn't it? Or anti-asylum-wise?
Potentially, yeah. It's a little uncomfortable on the title of the report. Yeah, it's mental health connotations. It's pure Douglas Adams on this one. But I really hope that whichever party comes in maintains the government's focus on the investment approach. So they're trying to figure out which policies work towards mitigating real hardship, and then rolling out more broadly the ones that do work. And they can apply that very well in mental health as well as in the areas that they are working through now.